This episode of Linoleum Knife is brought to you by Film Movement Plus.
It sure is.
That's a streaming service.
Yes, it is.
Would you like to know what's on it?
I would.
Well, I'll tell you. This week, The Wild Goose Lake.
Yes.
One of those early 2020 releases that got lost in the shuffle of the world becoming a very terrible and terrifying place.
Movie theaters closing like that's nobody's right. business.
The Wild Goose Lake is by directed by Diao Yinan. Mm. And it's a contemporary noir about a small-time mob leader who accidentally kills a cop. And then a bounty is placed on his head. And he goes on the lam. He runs in with the police and some dangerous gangsters and a femme fatale.
Yo.
It's very cool. And it's on Film Movement Plus now.
It is.
You finally get to see it.
That's right.
If you, you know, didn't have a chance before. You know what else is on Film Movement Plus right now?
Do tell.
Alonso.
Yes, Dave.
Fritz Lang's The Tiger of Eshnapur and the Indian Tomb.
Ooh.
Which is a two-film... what is it called when there's two movies? It's not a trilogy.
It's a diptych. It's a saga.
It's a twoogy.
Look, it's Fritz Lang in India. We'll call it a saga.
Yeah, it's a saga. And I've never seen them.
Cool.
They're from the 50s.
All right.
Every once in a while, you know, you're like, hey, I'm a film critic and I know things and I've seen movies. And then you're like, oh, well, I didn't.
But I haven't seen that.
I haven't seen that. So it's, now I can.
Well, all right.
There's a 2016 film called Soul on a String.
Mm-hmm.
That little noise is not part of the title.
No.
Soul on a String from Zhang Yang.
Mm-hmm.
Which is a Tibetan
film
about a Tibetan wanderer who embarks on a mission of redemption, trying to return a divine artifact to its home, the holy mountain of Buddha. He's got black market traders in his way.
Mm.
I hope he gets them.
I hope so, too.
There's also Iceman, a film from Felix Randau,
mm-hmm.
set 5,000 years ago.
No.
About a leader of a Neolithic clan where his settlement is raided, his entire tribe is murdered, and he is on a mission of vengeance. There's also another film from 2016, the Oscar nominee for Best Foreign Language Film, called Teeb. It's by Naji Abu Novar. And it's about a young man and his younger brother who live isolated from the conflict in World War I. And into their quiet existence comes the British Army.
Oh.
Yeah.
So what you're saying is Film Movement Plus has
A ton of things. You want Film Movement Plus.
Films from around
the world.
You
should have it.
A vast selection.
You're listening to this show, Linoleum Knife. That means you enjoy and
are a refined palate.
Enthusiastic. Well, what it means is that you are about world cinema because that's what we are often about.
Mm-hmm.
And unless you're ignoring everything we say,
just bleep right over it. You're just here for the recipes.
This is the kind of streaming service you want.
Yes.
Tell them what they get.
Well, there is a special deal for you. Very refined palate listeners of Linoleum Knife, get a 30-day free trial plus 50% off your first three paid months. Use the promo code KNIFE at checkout. That's KNIFE, KNIFE at checkout at filmmovementplus.com, and they will get you taken care of.
Who wants theme music?
Oh, me, please.
We all want it.
A podcast of the cinema.
Which, you know, you already knew that from the little intro.
Giveaway.
What's your name?
I'm Alonzo Duraldi.
A thing I also already said.
True. Yeah. I'm a film reviews editor at The Wrap and co-host of several other podcasts, including Breakfast All Day and Who Shot Ya and A Film and a Movie.
I'm Dave White. I'm a film critic, too. Jobless, but, you know, still here.
Yes, making it happen.
I'm making sandwiches happen for the most part.
Lots of things are going on.
I mean, yeah. I do produce this podcast, so that's a thing that I do.
That's right.
Yeah. A little bit of money. A little bit of ad money from Movement Film Movement Plus. Love it.
Bless their hearts.
I tell you something. After watching Bad Hair yesterday, I've had nothing but my beloved New Jack Swing in my head, because there's not a lot of actual New Jack Swing songs in the film. Like, they've written some original stuff for the movie, and you get to hear a bit of Bobby Brown's My Prerogative. But, like, there were so many songs back then that are just, if there's a genre of music that I miss, that just, it went away quicker than I wanted to. It's sort of like you've got a really good ice cream cone and then someone knocks it out of your hands and says, no more. Like, it went away as quickly as it came. Not as quickly as it came. It had a good 5-6 year run.
Right.
Like, from like the mid 80s to early 90s.
But yeah, it was very distinctively a moment that happened and then ended.
Like, Karen White, The Way You Love Me. That song is a jam. Alexander O'Neill's Fake, another one, super jam. Michelle A, obviously. Vanessa Williams herself, who's in Bad Hair, with The Right Stuff. Remember that song?
Oh, yeah.
I'll Be Sure.
Like,
Troop Guy, which was Teddy Riley's group, which they didn't really... Guy didn't cross over onto the pop charts. Like, they were always kind of on the R&B charts, but... Such good songs, and
like,
and kind of that's what this movie's about.
Yeah. New Jack was such a thing that went away that when they brought it back in that one song on Crazy Ex-Girlfriend.
Yeah.
The Don't Go to Law School lawyer song.
Yeah.
It was like, oh.
Oh,
period.
His name, the guy. The good singer who's so great.
Sounds like syllables.
Why am I blanking on his name? Pause the recording.
Give me something to work with here.
Uptown Funk.
Bruno Mars.
Bruno Mars. Thank you. When Bruno Mars did
Dave is terrible at charades.
When Bruno Mars did that song with Cardi B, I was like, is Bruno Mars going to bring New Jack Swing? Like, is it going to bring it back for everyone forever? Like,
is that the one?
Do we get to have it again?
Where the video looked like in living color?
Yes.
Okay, yeah.
Yes. I was so excited in that moment thinking, is this the resurgence? Like, is it coming back around? Do we get to have another sweep of hits from all these different people doing this style again? No. Dave, did not get to have that.
Dave wants to wear Dwayne Wayne glasses and the culture will not let him.
I was never... Like, fashion-wise, a part of it, because fashion-wise, I looked like a person who may have been in Yola Tingo, and that was kind of just it. Or
that was the look, you
know, Sonic Youth, you know, just like drab everything, ripped up jeans and t-shirts.
Record store clerk.
Record store clerk. I could have been in Pavement if anyone in Pavement had been fat. Like, that. That was my... Aesthetic, but that didn't mean that I only wanted to hear Pavement and Sonic Youth and Yola Tango. I needed so much more. New Jack Swing was that thing. Oh, such good movie music. Children, The children need to learn. The children do not understand. Do yourself a favor, young people. Please go find, perhaps in your parents' closet, a CD compilation, probably from Entertainment Weekly, that they got for subscribing, that has many of those songs on it, I betcha.
It's weird that, like, I mean, because certainly, like, there are sort of fashion and hair choices of that period that were very much of that period.
Yep.
Not the Kid and Play music as much as the Kid and Play hairstyles.
Yes.
But, like, why did that subgenre, like, why was it so specifically pointed and then abandoned, you know?
Pointed. What do you mean pointed?
Not pointed, but, like, so specifically, like, huge and then gone.
Here's what I think happened. And someone can correct me because I'm probably wrong. But my memory of that moment is that New Jack Swing existed at the same time that a lot of sort of neo-bubblegum was taking place on the pop charts. Tiffany, Debbie Gibson, New Kids on the block.
Right.
And Taylor Dane. A lot of, like, you know, there were some stock Aitken Waterman people sort of infiltrating the American charts, like Rick Astley.
And so...
That was a late 80s moment. And then, like a 1-2 punch, NWA and Nirvana took over everything. And suddenly, what was bright and shiny, and that New Jack Swing was bright and shiny.
It was.
What was bright and shiny on both the pop charts and the R&B charts, and sometimes, you know, a little bit here, crossing over here and there. It felt like it all got obliterated when suddenly, you know, boys were back and they were going to be mean and rough and yelling. whether it was in a band like Nirvana or whether it was in a band like NWA. And so you had this 1-2, like I say, 1-2 punch of grunge and alternative music and hip-hop, like a hard version of hip-hop.
Right.
You know.
Political hip-hop.
Yeah. And so that's me pretending to be Grill Marcus for 3 seconds. Don't quote me on any of this, but that's how it felt.
That's a valid theory.
That's how it felt at the time.
Yeah.
It felt like suddenly a different aesthetic moved in and said goodbye to all the rest of you. And that's, you know.
Yeah.
But of course, then you had groups like, you know, En Vogue and stuff that
sure.
sort of wove their way all through all that. And people, you know, really wanted that.
Yeah. You had Vanessa Williams save the best for last.
Right. Vanessa Williams became a ballad lady.
Right.
You know, she sang Save the Best for Last. She sang The Colors of the Wind, you know.
Oh, God, I forgot about that.
Unless,
one.
Was that her? That was her, right? She did a cover.
Not in the movie, but the closing credits, like, pop single version, yes.
And so, but the first time I heard Vanessa Williams sing, it was The Right Stuff.
Mm.
And that was great. I get very excited when I think about New Jack Swing. I also think, let's just talk about the movie. Bad Hair is so much fun.
Yeah.
And so smart about the things that it's about.
Mm-hmm.
Yet it doesn't feel like any kind of lesson is taking place.
No.
Everything is woven very skillfully in clearly a budget genre film. And before we go any further, we have to say,
disclaimer,
that technically we are not sort of really reviewing this. We're just being enthusiasts because Justin Simien, the filmmaker, who is also the man behind Dear White People, the film and the TV series. He's a friend of ours.
Yes.
We know him. And
but we're sticking with our usual
rule. But we are
rule,
also fans.
Which is when our friends make things we don't like,
we don't talk about it.
But we like this, so we are talking about it. Yeah. So this is his sophomore feature after the twin film TV juggernaut of Dear White People. And it is set in 1989 in Los Angeles about a young woman
named Anna,
who is working at a network that is very...
Culture Network.
It's called
the name of it.
Culture.
It's the network is called Culture.
Yeah. It's very BET-ish, and it operates under the shadow of a very MTV-ish network. And, you know, there's the implication that the MTV-ish network sort of vultures out, you know, the black crossover talent that gets nurtured and created on Culture. A new regime sweeps in. The big network boss, played by James Vanderbeek, installs a new network president who is a black supermodel, played by Vanessa Williams.
Right.
And so Anna, who, by the way, is played by L. Lorraine, who is great in this.
Have I seen her before?
She's on the Dear White People TV show.
Who is she on that? I mean, I haven't gotten...
I think she's done a couple of seasons. She's mainly from Insecure, actually.
Oh, okay.
Which we're behind on.
Yes.
Anyway, she is somebody who not only sort of longs to be on camera, but also has really good ideas and is a really good producer.
Okay.
And Vanessa Williams very immediately catches on to the fact that this is somebody whose ideas you want to steal. but she also suggests to Anna, who wears her hair naturally, that she should look into
a weave.
Yes. As a friend of ours who works in the industry was once told by an underling of a producer, the person waved their hand over our friend and said, let's clean this up.
Yeah.
So the implication there is that Anna needs to start, like, you know, having the long flowy hair.
Yeah.
And so she gets a card from a fancy salon called Virgie's, that is the main stylist is played by Virgie is Laverne Cox.
Yeah.
And so, you know, Anna shells out the money, goes through the procedure, gets the weave. The hair comes from someplace, and the hair wants things.
The hair exists independently of its wearer.
Yes, the hair is haunted. So, for me,
if you've seen In Fabric,
yeah, exactly,
you may be reminded of that,
or film. In Spider-Man 3, where he thinks Venom is a costume.
Yeah,
it's the same principle. So for me, this movie kind of felt like, you know, Simeon is obviously a great satirist. I think we've seen that in both of the manifestations of Dear White People.
Yeah.
And this is really smart satire about, you know, popular culture, about beauty standards, about the way that the white patriarchy dominates, you know, fashion and music and so many other sort of aesthetic industries. But it also, to me, kind of feels like this is Justin Simeon getting into Todd Haynes period territory,
mm-hmm.
where he's using a specific moment that he is personally into and obsessed with and
yes.
grew up with and
yes.
thrilled to be bringing back to life in a movie.
You'll hear people say lines of dialogue that are titles of Janet Jackson songs.
Yeah.
Because I know for a fact that Justin is obsessed with Janet Jackson.
But I think even they are doing it intentionally.
And they are, but it's a way, he's got his own way of, like you referenced Todd Haynes, Justin has his, Mr. Simeon, has his own way of taking all of this stuff in and creating a tapestry of ideas
right.
that... you know, some of them are more pronounced than others, but there's always a little, you know, thing sort of sticking out at you, you know, for you to notice.
Yeah.
I wouldn't call them Easter eggs, but they are They're details. He's very detail oriented.
Definitely. Yeah. So you can tell that he is reveling in the fashion and a lot of the other sort of aesthetic, you know, essence of 1989.
Yeah.
But I think also is very specifically using that moment as like the moment when white mass media starts noticing hip hop and starts noticing New Jack and starts noticing these things and like deciding, you know, we want you, we don't want you. Like you were saying before, you know, Guy didn't cross over, but, you know, Vanessa Williams clearly did. There's a lot going on here, but what I think was really fun is that he is doing this level of kind of satire and social commentary, and he's doing a genre horror film about a haunted weave.
Yeah.
And
that murders not just the bad people.
Exactly.
At first, it's just the people that are, like, not on Anna's side.
Yeah.
But then it takes over.
The weave is Audrey, too.
And, yeah. And it becomes a thing that begins to harm the people who are on her team, the
yes.
people she cares about.
Exactly.
Won't spoil any more than that.
So, but what I'm saying though is that the what he's pulling off here that is a very tricky balance, and we've seen people get it wrong a lot, which is yes, a lot of horror films are also making social commentary, but this movie never stops to like be preachy about the commentary, and it never undercuts the horror stuff. So both of those threads go all the way through to the very end, mm-hmm. and they always weave in and around at each other, but one never dominates the other one. And that, I think, is the real sort of coup he's pulled off here.
No, it ain't scary. Like,
not
it's
scary.
It's
scary.
Creepy and weird.
It's atmospheric, though.
But it's not. It's not a. It's a horror movie in the sense that it's about a horrific event.
Yeah.
But, you know, and there's good gory stuff in it, too, which very much satisfied me. But one of the things I liked about it is that it does ask, you know, what was the cost of the emergence of, you know, musical genres that were entirely by and for a black audience.
Mm.
What was the cost of that crossover?
Right.
You know, because it helped usher in hip hop. You know, it was hip hop, but it helped usher in, you know, a much more
palatable.
Well, not even palatable, but. The way that hip hop that was unpalatable became mainstream. And someone in the film talks about it. It's like, would you like to know what the kids are really buying right now? You know, do you think the audience do you think our older audience that you keep telling me about wants to see and hear that? You know, so when this music became a dominant force, when it helped to, you know, usher in a harder version of hip hop into the mainstream, which then over the past three decades has mostly replaced rock and roll in terms of relevance.
Right.
In terms of cultural relevance. What did that mean to, you know, what did that mean to the original audience? Now I'm a white person, so I don't know the answer to that. You have to, you know, listen to what black cultural critics say about this sort of thing. But there used to be real arguments about this.
Yeah.
I mean, even in hip hop, I remember in the early 90s, a hip hop group that I really loved, EPMD, that their big hit, their big pop radio hit was called Crossover. And it was about that very argument. The lyrics of the song are about, you can keep your crossover hits, we're going to stay real hip hop.
Mm.
Ironically, that was their biggest hit. And this was happening in punk and alternative music at the same time. There was this real disagreement about what direction it should take, or should it take, into the mainstream. When 80s bands like Husker Du and Sonic Youth and even REM started to sign to major labels and get these pushes into the mainstream. Mm-hmm. When you would see Husker Du on the Joan Rivers talk show. Do you know what I mean? Like, yes. Just weird stuff started happening. There was this great shift.
When Losing My Religion became a top 10 hit.
Yeah, there was this great shift, and it was happening all over the place. And so this is the version of the story that focuses on what happened in black music.
Yeah.
That moved out of a world where black audiences were consuming it exclusively.
Yeah.
And they show you in the film, like, the culture network becomes Cult.
Yeah.
And the videos that they were playing exclusively on Culture become part of what the film is referring to as an MTV style station.
Yeah.
With white VJs, you know, talking about essentially a Jody Watley, Janet Jackson, Karen White singer named Sandra, played by Kelly Rowland.
Yes.
So there's so much, there's so many layers of stuff going on here, and so many issues being thrown out, and at the same time, a weave is murdering people.
Yeah, but obviously, I think, you know, the weave as metaphor, I think, is an interesting choice, because, you know, when we had on a film and a movie, when we talked about Amarcord and Crooklyn,
right.
And our guest was Joelle Monique, and she talked about the semiotics of black hair.
Right.
And how, you know, the lead character in Crooklyn, when she goes to visit the relatives in the South, they immediately get the hot comb out,
right.
And straighten her hair.
Right.
And, like, what that means and what the implications, right. Of, you know, if you read the autobiography of Malcolm X, where he talks about conking,
right.
You know, the whole thing about the natural hair versus the not. So that, like, that as a central metaphor for this film about so many other aspects of black culture, I think is really fascinating.
And there's so much about hair in this film that continue to elude me as a 56-year-old queer white viewer.
Mm-hmm.
Because if you're paying attention to the world around you, you're going to hear about it here and there.
Yeah.
You know, starting when you're a little kid, me, I'm speaking of me, in the 1970s, watching Soul Train and all the Posner commercials, and wondering what they're about.
Yeah, like, what is a no-lie relaxer?
What is a relaxer? What does that mean? You know, what are these products and what are they for? And there's no one around. You grow up in a tiny little town in New Hampshire where there's only one black family. Who's going to answer that question for you? There's no internet. And so, you know, you pay attention here and there.
The straight and nappy number in school days.
In school days, you know, RuPaul having a hit in the 90s called Back to My Roots,
yeah.
Which is about black hair. Yeah. And it's as a white person consuming culture, you're thinking, I'm trying to learn these things. And then you think to yourself, will I ever get it? You know, like, am I too dumb and too white to get it ever?
I bet some cool writer there's a book out there that we just need to pick up.
Yes. Someone tell me what that
That's
book
on
is.
Us. Anyway, Bad Hair is streaming on Hulu and you should watch it.
Yeah. It's good.
Yeah.
Let's bring back, you know what we got to do?
What's that?
We got to talk about Ovid.
We do.
Talk about it a lot.
This episode of Linoleum Knife is also brought to you by Ovid.tv,
yep.
Which has an extraordinary selection of narrative and documentary feature and short film from around the world. And among the many documentaries they've got screening right now, several on some major figures in the arts. One about sculptor Ursula von Riddingsvard called Ursula von Riddingsvard Into Her Own. Magie Marin, Time to Act, about the French choreographer who was a contemporary of Pina Bausch's and integrated traditional dance with unexpected narrative, musical, and physical elements. And Edward Said, The Last Interview, the final testament from one of the 20th century's most influential public intellectuals and critics of colonialism. Also gearing up for Election Day, they've got a film called Advise and Dissent, where the Supreme Court and politics collide. And coming up in November, they're going to be showing one of my favorite films of recent years, the two-part A Bread Factory,
mm-hmm.
which if you have not watched, you know, this is a perfect way to catch it at home.
They also they have a thing, sort of an extra thing, right now. Kind of like a virtual cinema where you know you get your subscription or whatever, but then there's a special screening where you pay an extra ticket price for a film called Bamako. Do you remember that?
Yeah, the Danny Glover executive produced it. Mm-hmm. I think.
Yeah. It came out in the 2000s, and I've seen it. It's really great. It takes place in Mali, and some of the citizens of this village are holding a trial.
Uh-huh.
And on trial is the World Bank and the International Monetary Fund.
Ah!
And in the course of this trial, like, village life is taking place as well.
Sure.
And it's this sort of clash of, you know, political rage and, you know, the life in the village as it is influenced by the crushing domination of, you know, financial systems that keep countries like Mali poor.
Sure.
It's a great movie. It's from the filmmaker Abderrahmane Sissako, who also made Waiting for Happiness, and as you said, co-executive produced by Danny Glover, who has a cameo in it. And it's wonderful. You should watch it.
Cool. So, Ovid has a deal for Linoleum Life listeners. Use the code Linoleum, LINOLEUM. Take 50% off your first 3 months. Use the code Linoleum at checkout at www.ovid.tv. That's O-V as in Victor, I-D as in David, ovid.tv.
We watched American Utopia.
Yes.
Well, you watched it last week.
I did.
I finally caught up with it yesterday.
Mm-hmm.
David Byrne and Spike Lee.
Yeah.
So it's a David Byrne stage show that took place in on Broadway.
Mm-hmm.
2018? Yeah.
I thought it was 2019.
Was it 2019?
Yeah.
Okay.
I think it closed like in February of this year, actually.
Oh, did it really?
I think so.
Yeah. Well, that's, yeah, everything did.
Yeah.
So, did it close early or did it come to its natural conclusion in February?
I don't know.
Yeah.
But no, it was definitely more recent than that because he does the Janelle Monáe song and they reference, you know.
Was that added after?
It was part of the show.
I know, but do they say George Floyd's name and Breonna Taylor's name in the song itself? Because that in the song, it's the Hell You Talkin' 'Bout is the name of the song. And it's a Janelle Monáe song. It's the one non-David Byrne / Talking Heads song in the film.
Yeah.
He asked her permission to include it in the show. But I'm wondering if in post-production, because they don't say the names of people like Breonna Taylor and George Floyd in the song, they show you their faces and their names.
Oh, okay.
And I'm wondering if that was added in post.
That might have been. I mean, tragically, I suspect that for Janelle Monáe, like, the idea of this song is that it will be updated as sadly necessary.
Yeah. So what you have here is Spike Lee filming this David Byrne show. And it's an all musical show with Byrne speaking directly to the audience in between songs.
Yeah.
Explaining songs, explaining himself, as he's grown older and has changed somewhat, talking about the state of the world, talking about the necessity of voting. In case you hadn't heard, you guys, you should vote. Have you heard about voting? You should be doing that.
Facebook would like to know if you are registered.
Yeah. In the lobby, you can register to vote. You know, it's that kind of thing. And it begins with, you know, very much in the way that Stop Making Sense began.
Mm.
It begins with him.
Yeah.
And a couple dancers.
Right.
And bit by bit, people come out and they're all wearing the same sort of loose-fitting, shiny gray suits. These kind of blue-gray suits on the floor.
gray shirts.
The gray shirts. The floor is the same color. The sort of beaded curtains that open no matter where you walk in or out of them are the same color. I got to say, the floor, very, very clean because everyone's in bare feet. You know what I don't like? Bare feet on a stage.
Well, take it up with Pina Bausch.
I especially don't like... Especially don't like bare feet on a stage with a camera close up on the bare feet on a stage. Not that I have a problem with feet, but dirty porn feet are just not my thing. Well, and so I was very pleased.
Up with Merce Cunningham.
I was very pleased to find out. Look, we've all got things that make us go, eh. I was very pleased to discover that the floor was impeccably clean, because about midway through the show, two-thirds away through the show, you see the bottoms of some of the feet of the people who are the musicians and the dancers, and it's pretty clean. Like, they're not picking up a lot of goop from the floor. And I went, phew. I was relieved.
Spike Lee has your needs in
mind. Thank you, Spike Lee. Thank you, Spike Lee. I don't know who's responsible for the very clean floor that they were on. But grateful audience member right here.
Yeah, I think this is a movie that's dealing with, well, you would say three challenges because of the clean feet. I would say that there are two challenges here. One is that, like, David Byrne at, you know, an age when in many
68.
Fields one would be retiring.
He is 68.
He is still very energetically, like, leading a full show and concert of music and performing songs from his past.
Yes.
And Spike Lee having to live up to Jonathan Demme's Stop Making Sense, which is universally considered to be one of the great performance films ever made.
What I like about Spike Lee's approach here is that he is really unobtrusive and he's letting the show do the show.
Yes.
He's not giving you signature Spike Lee visuals.
Yes, David Byrne never comes toward the camera as everything behind him pulls away.
Although it would have been cool if he had. I obviously the show was not designed with Spike Lee's film version in mind, but
you don't know.
But to that end, Spike Lee is doing a very clean, smooth, utilitarian directing job here.
It, you know, he'll throw in some of the, if you watched the Hamilton adaptation on Disney Plus, you'll get the camera in the rafters shooting directly down on the stage shot. Not that Hamilton invented it either, obviously. But yeah, he's pretty much letting it happen and not butting into it.
Yeah. I mean, it's not like there's a fixed camera and all you're doing is watching. The camera moves.
Yeah. The editing is very fluid.
Editing. Yeah. It's appropriate and lets David Byrne's vision be David Byrne's vision.
Yes.
It's a collaboration where, you know, the guy who invented the show has his show showcased.
Yeah. To quote a Steven Soderbergh line I always like, the director is not standing between the audience and the screen waving his arms around.
I know that you love to talk about that when you talk about people such as, not Spike Lee, actually.
No.
But Quentin Tarantino.
For instance.
Yes. What is this about?
I mean, you know, the
because I have some ideas.
I mean, the title, obviously, and the, you know, the go register to vote in the lobby stuff.
Yes.
Clearly, I think they are sort of shooting for this notion of, like, a better sense of ourselves and an elevated sense of humanity and an improvement beyond where we are right now. And I think, you know, the fact that they have that whole centerpiece built around Hell You Talking About, you know, is about, like, here's the thing that's happening right now, and we need to be better than this, and we need to make this stop being a thing.
Yeah.
And so the idea of achieving an American utopia is, I think, part of the undercurrent. But again, I think part of it is David Byrne getting close to 70 and being like, I can still do this, and I still want to do this, and I think there's a lot of joy to be had here. And I think this is a joyous experience. You know, a lot of critics have talked about, like, dancing in their living room while watching it.
You know? Yeah.
And it's, it is.
I didn't do that.
I didn't either. But
I had some Cool Ranch Doritos.
But
I was on the couch.
It is a film, and this is not an adjective I use very much in talking about movies, but I would say this movie is buoyant.
Yeah.
And I like that about it. And I think it's trying to just sort of be like, it's, this is David Byrne's idea of being cheerful, I guess. I don't know.
I gotta say, I'm so glad I didn't have to watch any of those film critics dancing.
That would have been painful.
It would have looked like, you know, me dancing, probably. No. You know what it would have looked like? The audience of this show.
Yeah, that's the thing.
If I'm going to yell at Spike Lee about anything,
the American Utopia
is that
does
I
not
had
extend.
To look at the audience of the show in the theater dancing.
Yeah.
You know what I don't want to see? That.
And this is an audience of people who can afford Broadway tickets.
Oh, yeah. Those front row seats started at $300.
Mm.
Don't want to watch those folks dance. I do not. The one audience member I liked was the very last woman that you see. Do you remember her?
I don't.
The very last number, I won't spoil it because it's a show-stopping closer, right? But they leave the stage and they're marching around the room. Right, and it's a small theater. It's not a big theater.
Yeah.
And when they get, it's almost like a game of musical chairs. When they stop, David Byrne is standing right in front of a woman on the front row whose face is exploding with joy because he is 6 inches away from her, singing into her face. And she's like, I never knew I could be this happy. Like, that was cool. But otherwise,
yeah, I could have lived without that.
Oof, watching the people dance or be really enthusiastic.
Dorky New Yorkers. New Dorkers, if you will.
Fortunately, there's not a lot of that.
No.
There's just enough to make me go, nope, come here, come here, stop, stop it, nope, I don't want to see it. Oh, okay. Yeah. Talking Heads.
Yes.
In 1981. I'm going to get real personal here.
Okay.
Kid in a small town in New Mexico listening to Talking Heads. Do you know what that meant? Do you know what that was about? You know what that meant to you if you were that kid?
Nobody else was listening to that.
That is correct. And that doesn't mean I'm cool. It just means there was something about me that needed that. But I went back and I looked at some of the videos that Talking Heads made at that time. The video for Once in a Lifetime, mm-hmm. which is a song that is featured in this film.
I will say this. There's such a catalog going on here that every time they got to a song, they thought, oh, well, this must be the finale.
Yeah, no.
Nope. There was more, right. You know, and there's just so many like great songs in there.
The video for Once in a Lifetime. David Byrne is, first of all, the band is not in the video. It's just him.
Right. And
multiplied versions of him.
Yeah. Choreographed by?
Twyla Tharp.
Tony Basil.
Interesting. Okay. But maybe, yes. Yeah. His work with Twyla Tharp maybe preceded what they had done before. He's sweating profusely. He looks nervous and anxious. He's disoriented looking. It's like he's not located in the world that, you know, that you can see around you, you know.
It's kind of like the way Mark Mothersbaugh looked in a lot of the early videos.
Yeah, sweaty and nervous.
Yeah.
Upset, anxious, dislocated.
Yeah.
Right? As the song progresses, it is as though David Byrne is being pummeled by this invisible force.
Mm.
It's not a song that you think of when you think buoyant, joyous, let's all dance. What a communal moment we're all having. No, it was a song about feeling alienated,
dissociated
from the world around you. Not anymore. 40 years later, it's a different song.
Yeah.
And he touches on this in the show where they perform a song that he wrote called "Everybody's Coming to My House." I think that's the name of it. And he talks about how he gave the song to a high school choir. And he said, "Why don't you sing this song?" And he said, and they did. And they didn't change a word of it. And it was a different song. Because the way he sang it, he says, he felt like the underlying theme of the song is, oh no, everybody's coming to my house and they're never going to leave. And that's the lyrics of the song are, everyone's coming to my house and they're never going to leave. And when the kids sing it, the kids are like, hey, everybody, everybody's coming to my house and they're never going to leave. And probably Daft Punk is going to be here too. And so a song that was about one thing once becomes about something else later for any number, for a lot of different reasons. But same thing with Burning Down the House. Same thing with Road to Nowhere, you know.
But the thing is, I think the instrumentation on those songs is so bouncy and upbeat. Mm-hmm. Like you hear that opening thing of Once in a Lifetime and you don't think, oh, song about alienation. You think, ooh, I love this song.
You think, ooh, I love this
song. And Road to Nowhere has like accordions and everything. And it's just like, yeah, the lyrics are bleak, but the songs are,
Once in a Lifetime was not a big hit on the radio.
No.
When it came out, because the opening sounds of that song are, you know, like that's not what music sounded like on the radio then. Anywhere.
Our ears caught up with it.
And so this show feels to me like a couple things. It feels like a career summation.
Mm-hmm.
But also sort of it feels like a commentary on how the ideas presented by people like Talking Heads in the 70s, people who came out of art rock and avant-garde and to some degree punk.
Yeah.
Those ideas, those models of musicianship and sort of delivery of an aesthetic system, right, became very palatable as time went on, as people became sort of more familiar with it. You know, the thing that hurts your ears the first time, the 10th time, you think, oh, I'm beginning to feel what this is about. I'm beginning to get what this is. And it's still strange to me, maybe, because it's not a love song. It's a song about maybe hating your life.
Mm-hmm.
And yet at the same time, I want to dance to it.
Well,
and so that becomes a lot of dissonance in your head and in your body. So, but over time, over the years, over 40 years, you know, this is the music that you hear on National Public Radio. David Byrne is like the hero of NPR in terms of, you know, musicians.
Yeah. You hear Once in a Lifetime in trailers for Tom Hanks movies.
Yes.
But, you know,
none of this is bad.
No.
But what once felt alienating has now feels soft and communal and full of, you know, we're all in this together sort of messages.
Okay, but what did it feel like in 1984 when Stop Making Sense came out? Did it still feel alienating then, or was that performance so joyous that it already made it feel like this is upbeat music?
Stop Making Sense was, again, not a big, huge box office hit.
No.
It didn't set the world on fire. It was a cult film.
Yes.
That would get played at midnights.
Yes.
Quite often. And yes, it was happy and joyous because by that point, they had become well-known. Mm-hmm. They had already had a big hit with Burning Down the House.
Right.
And yet at the same time, it felt like this is still a movie for us. You know what I mean?
Well, I think there's a couple of things happening. I think
it was not a movie for my younger brother.
Sure.
My younger brother, who walked into the house one day, I've told this story more than once, but you're going to hear it again. Walked into the house one day. I had a cassette in the tape player. It was New Order, Blue Monday. Mm-hmm. And he goes, what's this? This was 1985. And I said, it's New Order. And he goes, never heard of them. And I said, well, they're kind of a big deal. He goes, they're not a big deal if I've never heard of them. And then that was it. That was his, the end of his
conversation.
He doesn't know that it's 2020, and my younger brother doesn't know that there was a band ever named New Order, because he forgot that conversation because they don't mean anything to him.
But he's heard who knows how many TV commercials that have like Bizarre Love Triangle in them, and he kind of knows that
for
tune
sure.
Now.
Yeah,
I think that there's two things going on. One is that, as you know, what's the Mick Jagger line? Like, in America, they want to arrest you and then they throw you into a museum. Like, things that start out as being unpalatable and avant-garde and confusing eventually get or very frequently get embraced by the mainstream and lose whatever made them scary. Second of all, there is, I think, a tendency about pop songs where people will hone in on a hook or the instrumentation and completely miss the point of what the song is even about.
Right.
Vis-a-vis people who think REM's The One I Love is a love song, or Every Breath You Take by The Police, or With or Without You by U2.
Or that Born in the USA is a patriotic anthem.
Exactly.
Right. So, again, I need to reiterate, I'm not here to talk about how cool I was in the 80s or how, you know, people are dummies for not understanding Talking Heads. That is not what I mean.
Mm-hmm.
What I mean is the world changed.
Yeah.
And this thing that was once, you know, pushy and maybe even upsetting to people, you know. I remember when I was a kid looking at Elvis Costello on TV the first time and being afraid of him.
Mm-hmm.
And David Byrne didn't look that much different from Elvis Costello at the time. It was actually maybe even skinnier and more serial killer looking.
Yeah.
In fact.
I found them off-putting until I saw Stop Making Sense my freshman year in college. That's when I started really liking them. Although I knew Burning Down the House because that video was omnipresent.
So how did this become cozy? How did this become comfortable? Especially since it feels as though the world has become meaner over time. How many of the people in that audience voted for Ronald Reagan? Mm. How many of those people, you know, are disconnected from the very thing that they're celebrating and dancing to? I want to know the answers to this.
I mean, here's the thing about...
What am I missing in this equation, I guess? I'm asking a question of myself. What do I not understand here?
I think Once in a Lifetime poses a challenging question that's also a very relatable question.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think it's very easy for somebody to be all like, this is not my beautiful house, and
ha, ha, ha.
Be kind of ha, ha, ha about it, but also like, but no, really, this is not my beautiful house, you know? And so I think it's a way that it makes that conversation comfortable for people to have with themselves or with others. And because it's to a bouncy beat, then so much the better.
Right.
And so you can have both of those things in your head at the same time.
Mm-hmm.
Do you think that this show is designed to, like, drive the final nail into Talking Heads being remotely edgy?
I don't like the word edgy,
but you know what I mean, like artful or challenging, or, you know.
Well, I wonder about that.
Non-mainstream.
I wonder where the challenge lies. You know, I was thinking about this as the show went on. I wanted to know if he was going to perform a song that was on I think it's on the Ray Momo record,
mm-hmm.
called "Dirty Old Town."
Mm-hmm.
I wanted to know if that was going to be part of the show because it felt like it would be relevant.
Yeah.
You know, it's a very moving song about people struggling, set to an incredibly danceable, you know, track.
Hmm.
It's not in the show.
Hmm.
And I thought, who is comforted? Who is afflicted? And I want to know the answer to that. I know that Byrne himself, in the course of the show, in the things he says, he talks about how he wants to change. He wants to become a better person. He wants all of us to become better people. And any thinking human being with, you know, an investment in the future wants that as well.
Sure.
How does that happen? I like this movie a lot. because I love Talking Heads and I love the music of David Byrne. And when they do Naive Melody, it gets me choked up because it's such a beautiful song, you know, about being home. And hopefully your home being a place where you can rest. And the United States is not a place where you can rest right now at all, if you have any kind of brain in your head, which I know is what the title of this show is about. There is no American utopia, and it's a thing that may never happen.
But we should always strive for it.
And yeah, and that's the point. He's saying we should keep trying. Yeah. You know, he says he has hope. That's a thing that is explicitly stated in this film. Do you get there by soothing people or by poking at them?
I guess that's the eternal question. Carrot or stick?
Linoleum Knife has no answers.
Yes.
Just by the way, no. We don't know anything about anything. But you did watch the new Wang Wang film.
Yes. Coming Home Again.
And I did not. Why don't you talk about
it?
You did. You can hear a lot more about this if you listen to the podcast that is named A Film and a Movie.
Yes.
Starring Mr. Durrell.
Yeah, Dan and I.
And Daniel Thompson from the Deck the Hallmark podcast. Yes. Where they had Wayne Wang on the show.
We did.
To talk about. The name of his new film is
Coming Home Again.
Coming Home Again.
Yes. And he talked about it in conjunction with Jean Dielman, which was a perfect pairing because so much about Coming Home Again, it's set pretty much entirely in an apartment. And it is about a young man who is trying to prepare the sort of traditional New Year's banquet that his mother always made when he was growing up. His mother is currently in the sort of final stages of cancer. And so he's trying to make this meal as a way of sort of keeping the family together and, you know, addressing issues from his past and guilt about certain things. The son is played by Justin Chan, who's an amazing actor. He was in an acclaimed indie whose title I feel weird saying because it is a slur, but it starts with G and ends with a K, and you can look it up. Justin Chan, C-H-O-N, the mother's played by Jackie Chung. They're both really amazing. And yeah, this is a almost at times suffocatingly intimate film. Like you are in this apartment and you almost never leave it.
Yeah.
And so much of it is very, you know, about the meticulous crafting of this meal. You know, as food porn goes, you know, it is definitely a lot to look at, and it will make you hungry. Wang consulted with the legendary Korean chef Corey Lee on the meal stuff. This is, if you've never seen Jean Dielman, the Chantal Ackerman classic, which is on the Criterion Channel, you should, and you should also watch this one. Both of these films require a lot of attention because they're very quiet, they're very meticulous, and you have to sort of enter their worlds and not be looking at your phone. This one is much, much shorter than Jean Dielman, so maybe you could watch it first if you wanted. I don't know.
The only film longer than Jean Dielman is Satan Tango. So,
it's really gorgeous. And like Wayne Wang has had a wild career. I mean, like this is a guy who starts off with films like Chan Is Missing and Eat a Bowl of Tea, these very kind of, you know, scruffy indie steeped in the Asian American community films. You know, makes the Joy Luck Club because, like, you know, Hollywood is finally ready to make an Asian epic and he's the guy they turn to, and he was the right choice for it, certainly.
Saw that on Super Bowl Sunday with an old boyfriend.
Funny.
Let me tell you something. Packed house.
Well, yeah.
some gays and a lot of ladies.
You want to be alone on Super Bowl Sunday, you go see some dude movie.
Well, that's what I had done the year before that. I had gone to see Heat, and I had the whole theater to myself.
There you go.
It was beautiful. But then, you know, you get a boyfriend.
Yeah.
And then the boyfriend's favorite movie is, you know, Funny Girl.
That.
And we're like, what are we going to go see on Super Bowl Sunday? He's like, Joy Luck Club. And I was like, okay, cool, fine, whatever. Anyway, continue.
Directed Smoke, one of my favorite 90s indies. Interestingly, in the interview, when we sort of asked him, like, which film he feels like is has the most of him in it and is the sort of, you know, his the film that he feels is sort of most purely his own, he said Made in Manhattan.
Yeah?
Did not see that coming.
I saw Made in Manhattan and don't remember it at all, other than Jennifer Lopez is, you know, great.
He talked about, like, how Ralph Fiennes should be in more romantic comedies, and I cannot disagree with that.
Mm-hmm. Jennifer Lopez should be in more of everything.
It's true. Well, you know, look, she was great in Hustlers.
Yes.
I
need more Jennifer Lopez in more things.
Yeah, we have not heard the last from her as a film person. Anyway, yeah, Coming Home Again is quite lovely, and you know, it's if you are or have recently been dealing with family illness, it might be a little, you know, extra gut punchy, but it's worth it.
Okay, so here's what's going to happen now, because mm-hmm. we've been going for about an hour.
Uh-huh.
We're going to take a little intermission. So that I can put dinner in the oven.
Mm-hmm. No one needs to know any of this.
Three more films that we have to talk about. You know what? It's fine. Y'all, there are six movies on the docket today, and that's what's going to be like.
Where next week we'll be getting to The Witches and Nation Time, mm-hmm. Both of which I have already reviewed for the wrap. So yes. If you're dying to know, you can go read those right now. But Dave and I will be talking about them next time.
So give me a minute here. Let me put the stuff in the oven, and then we'll come back. We'll do the next three films. Read the letter that we've got for the week, and then this is turning into an extra long episode.
So. Okay.
Linoleum Knife is back with part two.
No one else left.
Well, I mean, you know, people in on the process. This is podcasting verite, right? It is.
Sure.
Yeah, sure it is.
Giving you a glimpse behind the scenes.
Hey, there's a new Sofia Coppola movie.
There is.
It's called On the Rocks.
There is.
What's it about?
So Rashida Jones stars as a woman who is a blocked author, and she is married to...
She's got a book deal. She can't figure out what she's going to do.
Mm-hmm. And she's got a husband with whom she once had a very passionate, very sexy relationship. And now he's all work, 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 and she's all getting the daughters into ballet class and trying to organize vacations. And, you know, they're in a bit of a rut. She begins to suspect that perhaps he is cheating on her. He comes back for a business trip with a female colleague's toiletry kit in his suitcase, little things like that.
Right.
She makes the mistake of airing her suspicions to her father, a cosmopolitan art dealer played by Bill Murray, who cheated on her mother and is the kind of guy who has, like, a pickup line for every woman who crosses his path. So naturally, of course, he thinks, well, yes, the husband must be cheating. So he decides that the two of them are going to start spying on him. They're going to catch him in the act. And this requires a lot of running around New York City and, you know, being goofy spies. And ultimately,
their level of sleuthing reminds me of that old Freddie Prinze Jr. movie,
Head Over Heels,
where the models are running around town. Like... All but like tiptoeing, like digga-digga-digga-digga, behind trees and sticking their heads out from the side.
It's very Scooby-Doo.
Yeah.
So ultimately this is, you know, as I've been saying, this is maybe the quintessential Bill Murray character that anybody has ever written. But this is still Rashida Jones's movie, or at least it belongs to both of them. And is about her character sort of figuring out herself and where she is and what she wants. And it is set in a very, very rarefied New York.
Rich.
but a rarefied New York that we don't very often see in movies with people of color in it.
That is correct.
So that's kind of exciting. But I was just really charmed, and I laughed constantly through this film.
It's very funny.
I loved the characters. It was a delight. I was delighted by this movie.
What you said it's about is exactly what it's about. It is a very simple story about trust and distrust and learning perhaps maybe to trust a secondary person that you have lost your trust in over the years.
Yeah.
Because the journey here is Rashida Jones's story.
Yes.
And it's not really at all about whether she finds out if Marlon Wayans is cheating on her or not. You do find out at the end what's really going on. And I'm not going to give that away, but what you're really looking at is a woman who has, very much like in Sofia Coppola's other films, has been in an environment that in a way has cloistered her.
Mm.
Now, unlike so many other Sofia Coppola narratives, she gets to go outside.
She's not literally cloistered.
She gets to leave the apartment. But the world that she's in, this incredibly moneyed atmosphere that she's in, is its own strange little bubble.
Yeah.
And there are all kinds of people around her reinforcing the bubble.
Yeah.
You know? Not the least of which is her husband, who works at a job that makes him a lot of money, and she's a writer who gets book deals and makes money doing it. So they've got assets. You get a feel for just how asset rich they are. In two moments, one explicit, one not explicit, both involving Cy Twombly. There's a scene where Bill Murray, as the art dealer, is in the house of a client slash friend, and Rashida Jones is with him, and they stop in front of a painting, and he says, "I would kill for that Twombly," meaning I want to be the one to sell it, right? They're standing in front of a Cy Twombly painting. Later in the film, Rashida Jones and Marlon Wayans' apartment opens up a little bit, and you see a big wall, and you see a very large, very Cy Twombly-esque looking painting on the wall. It's just in passing. No one mentions it. No one talks about it. The camera doesn't come close to it. But if you were looking at the other Cy Twombly painting in the beginning of the movie, or you know what Cy Twombly's paintings tend to look like, you see it and you go, "Oh, did Dad give that to you for your wedding? Is that your wedding present?" Like, it's... And the movie never says a word.
No.
Because you're meant to understand that these people have a deep cushion to catch their fall should something ever happen to them. So all the danger here, all the stakes are emotional.
Yeah.
Money doesn't fix your anxieties, right? It helps when you want to become Harriet the Spy, though.
Yes. No matter how rich you are, you will still shed one perfect tear into your gin martini, while Chet Baker sings, "I Get Along Without You Very Well."
Sofia Coppola understands the gorgeousness of having everything you need to suffer luxuriously. But she's also not disconnected from the emotions that I just mentioned. And here's the weird part.
To suffer gorgeously is still to suffer.
The relationship between Rashida Jones and Marlon Wayans is actually sort of not the point.
Yeah, no, this is about the father-daughter.
The father-daughter relationship is what is at stake here.
Both Sofia Coppola and Rashida Jones certainly bring a lot to the table as far as knowing what
Absolutely.
It's like to be in the wake of this larger-than-life gregarious...
There's an extra narrative going on here about the actor and the director, who both have very famous fathers.
Yeah.
Who did, you know, important work in their time.
Yeah.
And so there's that. And because of that, this really does stay a Sofia Coppola movie. Her domestic aesthetics are an ongoing narrative. I mentioned, you know, that cloistered environment, you know. But her stories are a hotel room, a girls' school, a home full of teenage girls, another hotel room, a palace.
A palace in Versailles.
Now a really rich apartment.
Yeah.
So there's this gilded cage everywhere you look in her work. And she's giving you variations on the experiences that she had kind of as a child of a world-famous filmmaker, but who now builds her own stories and films. They are not in her father's shadow. They are fully outside of it, but they're narratively mining this emotional terrain that she grew in. And that's the world that she presents to us all the time.
Yeah. I mean, like, going all the way back to her very first screenplay credit, which was on Francis Coppola's segment of New York Stories,
yes.
Life Without Zoe,
yeah.
which is very much modeled after the Eloise stories. Mm-hmm. And it's about a girl who lives in a hotel.
Yeah. So this is the one where the daughter of the larger-than-life man makes peace with that and gives that man a very generous resolution.
While at the same time clearly establishing herself to be her own person.
Correct. Yeah. And he gets, you know, taken to task by her
mm-hmm.
for his actions in life.
Yeah.
And he doesn't learn a thing.
Of course.
And she has to come to a point where she's like, you know what? It's fine.
Yeah.
You're always going to be this guy. Like she's going to still look at him askance.
Yeah.
But the film is giving him the gift of being exactly who he has always been and allowing him to float through life almost without injury.
Yeah. It's that thing of, we have a relationship. It's not like it's going away, but our relationship is now built on my complete adult understanding of who you are and not my child's eye view of you as this
betrayer
of either of a betrayer or mm-hmm. as the larger than life hero. Like you are neither of those things. You are a human being.
Right.
That I can now grasp with my own adult sensibilities, and I will always love that about you, even though I will always acknowledge both the heroic and the betrayal aspects of you.
And if they give Academy Awards for Best Supporting Actor for having a specific look on a face, then Bill Murray should win, because there's a moment where they're talking about why he left her mother.
Oh, God, yeah.
And he talks about the woman that he left her for. And then the heartbreak of losing her. And he has this face. And Rashida Jones sees this face and gets that, yeah, he was a jerk. And then life broke him a little bit. Then he bounced right back.
That's not a supporting performance. That's a lead.
It's that thing where you're in the middle of your life and think, I'm going to do this because I want to, but then, oops, it falls apart and it breaks you.
Mm.
Do you deserve sympathy?
After you've broken other people
after
by
you've
making
broken
a decision.
Other people by making a decision that then broke you?
Mm.
Maybe you don't deserve sympathy. But do you still feel that pain?
Yeah.
And he does.
Of course.
Can we talk about the cop scene?
I don't want to give too much away.
All right, well, let's talk around it then.
Scene.
It floored me.
That's Bill Murray's Oscar clip scene.
Oh, God. There's a scene with a cop, and they get stopped. Bill Murray gets stopped for running a red light. And what happens is what happens to a specific gregarious, charming, white, older man.
Yes.
For whom the world is absolutely tailored.
Mm.
In a way that he never understood, but just lives with.
Yeah.
And assumes is what life is.
Right.
The experience he has with this cop is like Gene Kelly dancing down the street in the rain. Not to spoil it too much. It's an incredible moment.
Yeah.
And Sofia Coppola knows just what she's doing.
Oh, absolutely.
Here. Yeah, I like this movie a lot. It's much more sly than you might give it credit for at first. Mm. Because, again, everyone is so damn rich in this movie that you're thinking, I hate all of you, just on principle, you know. But it's quite something.
I want to give a shout out to Jenny Slate also, who has a hilarious recurring bit.
God bless Jenny Slate and her weird ass. Everywhere she goes, may she thrive. But yeah, in this world,
this is I said this in my review, and I stand by it. I think that people are going to think, when they think about Bill Murray performances,
yeah,
they're going to think about this one the way they think about All About Eve for Bette Davis, among her body of work, which is that's the role that where she was not only great, but that it also really matches what a lot of people think she was really like, or that was, you know, that mirrors her true essence.
Right.
I think that's what people are going to come away with what Bill Murray does here. And I think it's that kind of role that's going to be, you know, decades after he is gone and we think about his career, this is going to be that role that we think about that is the sweet spot that brings all those things together.
Wes Anderson and Sofia Coppola have adopted him in a way that has turned him into something that he wasn't when he began. And I hope he's appreciative.
Yeah, because I mean, like you look at something like The Razor's Edge, where you know, like a movie that only he wanted to make, you know.
Yeah.
But like, yeah, I think they are very much along the lines of like, no, you're an actor,
right?
And we see it, and you're going to give that to us, and he does.
Yeah.
And nobody else seems to be really stepping up and asking him to do that, or that are asking, and he's just not answering his phone because apparently he's notoriously hard to track down.
Okay, we didn't like Borat and we didn't like Rebecca. Which one do we want to talk about first? Do we want to talk about the one that we were disappointed by, or the one that we just think is stupid?
I'm not even quite sure which is which.
I know which is which. I'll let you know which is which. Let's talk about being disappointed by Borat.
Okay. Yes.
Okay. Because we think Rebecca is stupid.
You're right. Yeah, no, I was disappointed by Borat because we really liked the first one.
And we are alone?
We're in a vast minority.
I feel a little surprised that every person that I know and whose opinion I respect is like, oh, I loved it. It's hilarious.
Yeah.
Like, we sat on the couch watching this.
Stone-faced
the whole time. I anyway, go on. Talk about it.
Okay, so yeah, the premise is that after the first film made Kazakhstan a global laughingstock, Borat has been busting rocks,
exiled to hard labor.
Yeah, yeah. And but he is freed from prison by the premier, who wants to be part of the Trump strongman club alongside North Korea and Russia and Brazil.
Yes.
So he sends Borat with a present to bribe Vice Premier Pence, that is a performing monkey that is Kazakhstan's most popular porn star.
Yes.
In transit, the monkey is eaten by Borat's daughter, who stows away in the hopes of getting closer to her father because she's useless. You know, she lives out in the barn or whatever.
Right.
He decides that without the monkey, that now the daughter maybe can be the gift. And so the whole movie is this attempt to give her makeovers and sort of teach her how to be a debutante, and then also to track down various leading conservatives to whom he might present her.
Mm-hmm.
When I originally reviewed it, Amazon was like, please don't reveal the famous people who are in this movie. And then the second the embargo lifted, it was like, Giuliani.
Right.
So I don't know what the point of that
was.
Who, by
the way, really is kind of just tucking in his shirt. That's basically what's happening.
It could go either way.
I mean, it could, but
he's tucking in his shirt via his fly. There's that.
I get it.
Anyway.
But when I watched it, I thought, is this going to be like distilled into a clip that makes it look like he's trying to get her in his pants? Or
that he's masturbating in
front of her? Anyway.
So Maria Bakalova plays the daughter, and she is game.
Let me tell you something about this woman. I don't know anything about her. But she is diving headfirst into this world and carries herself alongside Sacha Baron Cohen like she was already there and ready to go.
Yeah, Because he is, you know, the thing about
is
Baron
Cohen.
Is she
a newcomer? What has she been in?
She's a Bulgarian-born actress. She's been in some you know, international films like Transgression and The Father. I don't really know her stuff, to be honest.
Okay.
But, you know, oh, she was in Gomorrah.
The TV series Gomorrah.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You know, Baron Cohen, like, you know, he shared a Best Actor award from LA Film Critics the year that Borat came out.
Yes.
With Daniel Day-Lewis.
Yes.
Because, you know, there is like this heightened level of improv that he is doing where he is creating these bizarre characters and he's interacting with people who don't necessarily know what's going on. He very often seems like he's in danger or could be if things take a turn. And she is just as willing to like put herself out there and be outrageous and like embrace the moment and completely commit herself to whatever shenanigans are going on. So, you know, I have great respect for her. This movie did not make me laugh with maybe two or three times. And I don't know if it's just that I'm so broken by 2020 that I can't.
Not just 2020, but the past 4 years.
Sure. Yeah. Yes. That I just can't find any of this funny. I don't know if it's that the world has changed so much in the 14 years since Borat came out, because now you don't have to trick people into saying the awful racist or despicable thing. They'll just do it on Twitter.
They'll be hideous without your provocation or being sort of
ambushed
into it. Yeah.
You know, and also I think we've just all collectively gotten a little more sophisticated about how movies and TV get made. And so it's like, did everybody sign a release here? Obviously, because their face isn't blurred. So
if the people whose faces are blurred did not sign releases.
Yeah.
The people who were or were not tricked, either they were tricked into being on camera and then signed the release after when they realized, oh, you're in a Borat movie. Or
they signed the release first.
Or they signed the release first and they were in on the bit the whole time. And it's kind of sometimes difficult to tell who's who and who's doing what and who's already in the know.
Yeah.
That's somewhat irrelevant. But continue. Yeah.
So anyway, so it just kind of felt like, I don't know. I didn't, whatever the shock of the first film that made so much of it so funny is not here this time.
Right.
And so, and it's like, yeah, there are moments where he's going after the Giulianis and the Pences of the world. And those guys absolutely deserve to be dragged and embarrassed and whatever else you can do to them.
Whatever you can do to them.
Yeah.
But by any means necessary.
Exactly.
Whatever you can do to them. And so this is something, but
yeah, so instead it's like, well, we're going to ambush a debutante coach and, a cake decorator who he gets to write this, you know,
anti-Semitic thing,
which Luke Thompson had a great observation on Facebook, which is he goes, nobody ever talks about how much crap people in the service industry put up with and how much they have to sort of go along with terrible things that they are asked to do or that people are talking about in front of them. And it's true.
Right.
It's like, you know, if a waitress has to deal with a table full of racists and she serves them their food anyway, she needs the work. It's not that she's endorsing their point of view.
Right.
I don't know. So it just, none of this landed the way that Borat does the first time. With a few exceptions.
There are moments of this film that for me were kind of funny.
When he gets the crowd to sing along that we should cut up journalists the way the Saudis do?
No, not that, because that horrified me. Like, that's actually, to me, the Giuliani stuff, the Giuliani gotcha moment is less of a freak out to me than the fact that they got a whole crowd of people to sing a song enthusiastically endorsing the murder of journalists and politicians.
And scientists.
And scientists, yeah. That is more of a scare to me. I don't think satire is dead.
No.
But I think that it is undergoing some sort of transitional phase where we are going to have to come to the understanding that satire makes people laugh and makes them think and makes them talk. But it doesn't fix anything. Sometimes I think that Borat, their first film, and The Daily Show, operated under the assumption that we're going to point out the hypocrisy here in a funny way, and something will change because of it. Well, things didn't change. Things just got worse. And I'm going to assume the following, that this film is funny, but I'm just too depressed to laugh anymore about it. That, maybe that's it. When I say I was disappointed by this film, I think maybe what I'm upset about is the fact that I'm too bummed out all the time now to watch this and laugh and think that anything will come of it.
I mean, in my
other than this weekend when people are talking about it on social media.
In my review, I acknowledge that I could see maybe a happier future in which at which point I could find any of this funny.
Yeah.
But it's just not happening for me right now. I mean, I don't think you can judge satire on its efficacy. I mean,
you can't. I know.
Like to
I
be or, the original
right.
To Be or Not to Be is still a great movie, even if Hitler happened anyway.
I get it. I know what you mean, and that's true.
But this does feel like
I'm just so miserable about the way life turned out in the United States, and I'm afraid.
Yeah.
And I'm not in a position to laugh anymore.
Yeah.
And maybe someday I'll be in a position to laugh again about us being absolute idiots. But we're absolute idiots. And that really freaks me out. Every day that I'm here, like, baking a cake and going ha-ha on a podcast, that's just self-preservation.
Yeah.
It's unglamorous to do real work to try to make the world better, you know? And it's not something you want to go around tooting your horn about anyway, because then you're bragging about it. But none of it's amusing. And I can still be made to laugh. There are films that make me laugh. But I don't think of Giuliani as a joke right now. I think of him as a ghoul. Who's actively participating in a world, he's actively participating in a presidential administration that stands around and has its thumb up its butt while people die, and then they laugh about it.
Yeah.
They think that's fine. They think it's fine to kidnap children of migrants. They think it's fine that this virus is killing 1,000 people a day in the United States. They think it's fine. This is the plan. This is the design of what they want. And it's been the design for centuries. But now they're just saying it out loud explicitly and daring you to be upset about it.
If you like this movie, we don't judge you for it.
Maybe it's funny. Maybe it's funny. Maybe it's funny.
Yeah.
I'm just so wiped out.
Yeah. Yeah, it does just feel kind of like, I don't know, like spitballs against the tank. I don't know. It feels like, yeah, we're goofing on this thing, but we're telling you things that we all already know, and that the fact that we know them doesn't mean anything and doesn't change anything. Yeah, sorry if we're bumming you out, but that's just how this movie made us feel.
There's a good moment near the end in a synagogue where a woman who lived through the Holocaust talks to Borat.
Yes. And the very ending.
And it's moving.
And the this movie's updated version of the running of the Jews from the first film.
Yes.
Is very funny.
Is funny too. Yeah. Yeah. The lady in the synagogue moved me. Yeah. And
although
I.
Her daughter is suing him.
Really?
Yes. Because
interesting,
she passed away, and the daughter is claiming that like she did not know what she was signing up for.
I see. I don't know what to make of it.
Yeah.
I feel like a thermometer that's got the wrong temperature right now. You know, like I feel like I'm just wrong, and the world is wrong, and I don't know which way I'm pointing.
you know, it's just a reminder that, you know, criticism, and I think especially criticism of comedy, is crazily subjective.
Yeah.
And that's just the filter we've got on right now.
And then there's Rebecca.
Yeah, Ben Wheatley's Rebecca.
Hey, you guys, have you seen the film Rebecca from 1940, directed by Alfred Hitchcock? No? Go watch it.
Yes.
You should go watch it. It's incredible. It's an 80-year-old film that is riveting.
Yeah.
And you will not turn your head away.
This is a great Criterion Blu-ray.
It's about a woman who is uncertain of herself. She's meek and mousy and awkward. And she's a paid companion for a rich, boorish old woman. She meets a very rich man, very handsome rich man, while accompanying her employer on a vacation. She and the handsome rich man fall in love quickly. But he has a secret. And the secret is that he's a widower. And that the memory of his ex-wife haunts him.
And everyone he knows.
And everyone he knows. They marry quickly. He takes her back to this giant mansion in England called Manderley. Things don't go well. And then things get worse. And then it's over. And it's incredible. So imagine this spooky, gothic, haunted, mysterious,
ghosty,
ghostly, black and white film of mood and shadow and tension and anxiety and people in relationships that, even at their best, are
fraught,
full of friction and fraught with tension. Imagine they remade that film in sunny color, full of actors talking about their feelings for the entire time and explaining their needs and their worries and their fears and their sorrows. And then even the wildest villain of the film, she comes along and explains her feelings too. Not that you asked. Not that anyone asked. And then they all live happily ever after.
Almost all.
Well, that's the end. That's Rebecca. That's the new Rebecca. Streaming now on Netflix.
Somebody tweeted, it's ironic that there's a new Rebecca and all anyone can talk about is that they prefer the old one.
Well, yeah. There's a reason for that. This one stars Army Hammer and Lily
James.
James. And an amazing amount of production design and set direction and period detail.
Mm.
And a mustard yellow suit on Army Hammer that
will only look good on Army Hammer. Do not buy one.
He wears it the way Army Hammer wears anything Army Hammer wears. Army Hammer, let's go back to the On the Rocks movie for a minute. Army Hammer grew up in that way. This is the real Army Hammer. Our real Army Hammer grew up in a way that is that kind of rich where you don't even know that you're rich. Like, you just think that's the world.
Yeah.
And everything fits you, and you can just stride into any situation, and the world lays itself out for you like a red carpet. I'm not saying Army Hammer hasn't had any trouble in his life. I guess he has. I'm assuming he has.
You wouldn't see it in his face.
But okay. No, you don't. But I think as an actor, he's just fine.
Yeah.
And if with proper direction and proper everything else, he's not at fault. And he's not even at fault for this film.
No.
But what he is this kind of character who sets a tone.
Mm.
And the tone is, it's all going to be okay.
Easy, breezy, beautiful.
It's all going to be okay. I mean, just look at me. Am I not 6'5 and blonde and super handsome? Are you checking out the suit? If I can do this, I can take care of you and your problems, whatever they are, whatever's coming down the road.
Here's what I don't get.
Okay.
So, okay, you want to make a new Rebecca, and you want to make it the feelings kind.
Okay.
Where, like, everybody's sure. Over the...
Let's assume that's possible.
And all you right. Want to make it that's, like, the lush, creamy cars and linens and tea sets
right.
And rolling hills and, yes. You know, yep. Estate lawns. Very Downton Abbey, yes. Why do you hire Ben Wheatley that's as your another, director?
That's another question.
Because I don't particularly care for Ben Wheatley's work, but like he has a yeah. Thing that he brings to yes. Movies, and he has become popular for doing a certain kind of film
right.
That is not this kind.
No, not this kind.
So I don't get it.
This is a romantic drama.
Yeah.
About people who are really trying hard to make everything work out right for each other.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't know what I was watching
yeah,
half the time. But I'll tell you what, it looks great.
It does.
Oh, it looks so nice. Everyone is pretty.
I love Ann Dowd
as
the Bulgarian millionaire. The
great gowns, beautiful gowns.
Beautiful gowns.
Couches and lamps and rugs and paintings and staircases and cars and lawns and
beach cottages and
crown molding. You name
wainscoting. Portraits.
Yeah.
Writing desks.
You want to get a good look? Get a good look at it.
Yeah.
That you'll be happy.
Mm.
Bored out of your mind, but you'll be
foyers.
Happy looking at it. But P.U.
Yeah.
As we used to say as children in the 1970s, P.U.
Watch the Hitchcock one. Yes. It's great.
Please don't make the mistake of watching this one first and then thinking, I guess I don't need to watch that one that's from 1940. No, 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 no. You do.
Yeah.
It's
the
80-year-old
one is
thing.
Great.
It's a whole other movie. This one shouldn't even be called Rebecca.
No.
What a mess.
Do you want to do this letter or do you want to do it next week?
No, let's get the letter because I said okay. We were going to do the letter.
Okay. Okay.
I mean, I've been talking my face off for 90 minutes, but I do want to get to this letter because it's a letter that inspired a back and forth conversation.
Oh.
And normally that's not how we do the letters. Normally we read the letter and we talk about it on the thing, but on the show.
We get the last word.
This one this one became a conversation over the course of a few emails. Don't anybody get the big idea that that's how it's always going to be? But yes. That's how this one turned. That's what this one turned into.
We're not here for Socratic dialogue. Listen and learn.
But this comes from listener Shoddy, who's mm-hmm. written in before and who yes. Always has smart things to say.
Mm-hmm.
And she talks about a couple of things in the first letter, but what the conversation wound up being about was one of those things.
I see.
She says, I know I'm a bit late, but here's my two cents on I'm thinking of ending things.
Mm.
The movie starts out with a singularly delicate and heartbreaking performance from a perfect Jessie Buckley as a woman suffering from depression during a long car ride. And then it abruptly turns into a bloodless version of The Shining, with scrambled memories, shifting timelines, subjective identities, and rambling ghosts. And just like that, Mrs. Buckley is... Mrs.?
Ms.
Okay, it's the word, it's written as Mrs. I misread it. Ms. Buckley is reduced to spending the final two-thirds with her mouth agape and a bewildered look at her face so that Mr. Kaufman can turn the movie into White Guys Have Feelings Too, you know. And this betrayal of a delicately constructed female character is what I cannot forgive, because I feel like another movie has just been stolen from me by the whims of a genius, in quotes, white male director who ran out of empathy midway through. Now, this is not what we ended up talking about.
Mm-hmm.
This is a conversation that I can only have after I go back and rewatch the movie, because my first viewing of this film, I took away something different.
Yeah.
I took away from it a film about, you know, both of these people being fractured and broken by something.
Yeah.
and the first half being about her and the next half being about him. And so I didn't, that was not my takeaway.
Yeah.
But I do now because of this letter, I want to go back and look at it again and see how I see it this time
mm-hmm.
from another set of eyes. What we wind up talking about in the ongoing conversation is think back about a year to the Irishman.
Hmm.
She says, last year, you also, this is in all caps, mansplained to us how Anna Paquin makes a huge impact just by speaking 20 words in Netflix's The Irishman. Ouch, Shoddy. Ouch. She continues, I'm afraid I have to call out your BS on this. Don't tell me male directors like Martin Scorsese are casually granted $200 kajillion to F around with their buddies in a 3-hour-long drama while women should just be thankful for their 10 minutes of screen time, especially since Mr. Scorsese has also made 30 other dude movies of the century. So maybe it's about time that male director geniuses, in quotes, ask themselves if they are really making deep, thoughtful, universal, this is also in all caps, dramas about the human condition, or are they simply too busy feeding table scraps to women? Thank you for your time and your empathy. So I responded, we're totally going to talk about this on the next episode, if that's okay. And the next letter says, I'm sorry if I came on too strong. The truth is that women are almost always cast as an afterthought. They are rarely ever given equal screen time, and their scenes are always the ones that get cut out first. And just like Ms. Paquin, they almost always do a better job than their male counterparts, especially given how little they have to work with in the movie. I'm not even going to get into what it's like 99% of the movie sets where there are barely any female behind-the-scenes people outside of the makeup trailer. She said, so I was heartbroken when you guys went out of your way to explain to us how Anna Paquin really didn't need to be on screen any more than Scorsese had allowed her. So here was my response. You did not come on too strong at all. At all. I like it when people have strong opinions. Now, it's been a year. And I know that we talked about this quite a bit at the time because it became a topic of conversation among people who had seen the film, and I do remember that we were really emphatic about saying that we agreed with exactly how her character had been presented. Now, obviously, it's difficult for the mansplainer to see and hear himself mansplaining because we all live inside ourselves, so I am sorry if I was egregious about that. I can't say that I never mansplained, being a man whose job often involves explaining himself, but I need to know about it when I do it in a way that squashes other voices. Because I don't want to do that. But you are right. Not only is Scorsese's output heavily weighted toward male narratives, but with the exceptions of Boxcar Bertha, Alice Doesn't Live Here Anymore, and New York, New York, quite frequently the female characters react to the men and not the other way around. Combined with the history of cinema that has pushed women to the side, it's appropriate to read Paquin's role as yet another example of this. For me, personally, as a family story, I do still see her role as a very heavy and memorable example of moral oppositional weight, as well as an example of the oppressive and silencing quality of family secrets. Like in this narrative, his entire life of violence and crime is the thing that no one in his family will talk about. So they speak about other things or they don't speak at all. And so her screen time and her stare felt exceptionally powerful to me. I do wish that Martin Scorsese had built up enough memorable talking women over the years in his films so that this character didn't have to carry the burden of that history. Then she responds, there's still a little more. She said, we both agree on Ms. Paquin. What we don't agree on is the fact that the Irishman, and this is my favorite part, because she's right. The Irishman is really about a guy who quits his well-paying union job to kill people. And then he keeps feeling sorry about it for the next 3 hours as if he had no other way to feed his family. Boo-hoo, life is tough for a white man in the 60s. At least Henry Hill was too young to know better when he got recruited by Paul Sorvino. She's right. The character of Robert De Niro in The Irishman could have just had that nice union job his whole life. And everything would have been okay. And he would have had a family who loved him. But of course, then you wouldn't have a movie. What you then have is a movie that is... what you have now is a movie about a man who inexplicably chooses the path of destruction for the sake of what? Power? And, you know, what drives men to do that sort of thing?
And I would argue the movie punishes him for that choice.
It does punish him, but just emotionally.
Yeah, I mean, he is left alone in his age, yes, because he has no family there to be with him.
The point isn't really that the movie does something effectively or not does something effectively. The point is that given the history of women in cinema, mm-hmm, you know, women were the first filmmakers, you know, Alice Guy Blaschet and Lois Weber and you know, and then they got, and they were screenwriters, you know, mm-hmm, Dorothy Arzner, and then they just kind of got pushed out. It is a statistical fact that female characters in movies have less dialogue than men. You have entire casts, you know, six dudes and a woman playing a wife. You know, this happens over and over and over again. And sure, we've also had Joan Crawford and Betty Davis and the women's picture, and we've had feminist filmmakers and so much. But the history of cinema is misogynist. And it is at least as appropriate to look at Anna Paquin in the Irishman as maybe another example of that. There's another way to read this movie. We were emphatic about it because we loved what we saw from her. We loved the performance from her. This is a film in which women are literally sitting in the back seat of a car for much of the movie. It is a film about men, and the worlds that the men construct for themselves, the worlds that exclude the women. That's a story Scorsese wants to tell. Not saying he shouldn't tell that story.
See, that's
the
where...
solution is we need female filmmakers to like... here's a good example. A film critic I follow on Twitter, Miriam Bale.
Mm-hmm.
Love her.
Yes.
She tweeted, I guess at the beginning of 2018 or 2019, I can't remember now, that she was not going to watch any movie by a man for like all of 2019, or maybe any movie by a white man or something like that. It was one of those two. It was either that or a combination of things. Yeah. And I thought, that's actually kind of a good idea. Like, think of how much you'd get to watch from other perspectives.
Yeah.
If you took a year, just 1 year out of your life, you know, and did that. That's why I like this letter, and that's why I like this exchange, because you can agree on this performance as being astonishing. Anna Paquin's performance is astonishing. She is giving you gesture and face and a crushing silence. But that doesn't mean this film couldn't have done something else with its women, you know? Martin Scorsese is a great filmmaker. He could have done something else with these women in this film. He didn't have to do it like this. And run the risk of being yet another example of erasure.
I guess I'm an idealist because I want a
world
lot
where everybody gets their voice. Yeah.
Yes, me included.
Okay, I'll shut up.
I would like a lot more representation in cinema, and I would like a lot more kinds of filmmakers to get money and to get the license to tell the stories that are important to them and to present the world as they see it and to offer, you know, their art to the world. I want all of that.
Yeah.
And, you know, if you go again... one of my other podcasts, A Film and a Movie.
Yeah.
We've been working a lot with TCM over their Women Make Film series.
Right.
And so recently we've been talking to people like Winery KU and Kimberly Pierce.
Lizzie Borden.
Lizzie Borden, you know, which has been really exciting. And so, yes, I want all...
Who's our neighbor, we found out.
It's true. We have the same CVS. All of this stuff, I want that to happen, and I want to hear from those people, and certainly in my time working at Outfest,
right.
You know, it's been about, like, trying to hear from, you know, more trans directors,
yes.
and more bi stories,
right.
and more international,
right.
you know, places where you don't necessarily expect to hear, you know, the queer cinema is going to be happening. And at the same time, I like The Irishman, and I like, I'm Thinking of Ending Things.
Yes.
I think they're great. So, do we have to consider them in the context of the last century of cinema? Yes,
yes,
we do. So I don't have an answer to that. I will say that you and I are men, and we explain things on this show.
That's true. Yes. But no, I love this letter, and I love your perspective about these two films. You know, again, I got to go back and watch. I'm Thinking of Ending Things again. But yeah, no, your point is a valid one about what has led to, you know, a moment like this where, you know, we spent that time last year with people, you know, arguing about what that performance meant, you know, not narratively, but emblematically, you know what I mean?
Hmm.
So thanks for that. Have we hit 2 hours yet?
We're getting real close.
Okay.
So I won't do my usual long
list of
plugs.
End of
I
podcast.
Will mention real quick that I'm on Deck the Hallmark this week talking about the second of the Countdown to Christmas movies that aired over the weekend. Christmas Tree Lane. So do check out that episode when it drops later this week. Subscribe to this podcast at Apple Podcasts for free. Leave us a 5-star review. It helps people find the show. You can also leave positive feedback in the many places that we stream, including Spotify and Amazon Music and Google Play and CastBox and Podbean. Follow us at LinoleumCast on Twitter, Instagram, and Facebook. Drop us a line at linoleumpodcast@gmail.com. Check out our Patreon at patreon.com/linoleumknife. There's a lot of things there. Subscribers,
a lot of content, a lot of podcasts, a lot of things for you to hear.
Yeah,
yeah.
Subscribers have a full life, or at yeah. least a full.
We oh
have
boy,
an earful
you,
from
you,
us.
We talk to you a lot if you're a subscriber.
Plenty, yes. So, patreon.com/linoleumknife. Thanks for listening. Have a good week. We'll catch you guys next time. And until then,
goodbye.